American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from IFNet for Monday, August 29th, 2011. And you are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on corporate tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for free speech today is Misanthropic Gods.
You can follow all these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You can get there by going to smf.rantradio.com. This would be a free podcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Great Archers 155-74666. What we need most of all right now is your support. If you have something to send in, please email us at news@rostudios.org. That is news@rostudios.org. Joining us live in Second Life today is Agent Paranoia, Anastasia Jennings, Legion Rosenman, and Psychros.
$1 million to members of Debt Supercommittee. The bipartisan supercommittee created by the debt ceiling deal is comprised of lawmakers who have received big bucks from special interest groups, according to a report by Maplight. The committee is tasked with finding at least $1.2 trillion in deficit cuts over 10 years. In total, the 12 members appointed to the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction got nearly $64.5 million from special interest groups over the past decade, with legal firms donating about $31.5 million and Wall Street firms donating about $11.2 million. Of that $11.2 million, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, and JP Morgan Chase have donated approximately $2 million combined. The members appointed to the committee are Senators Pat Toomey, John Kyle, Rob Portman, Patty Murray, John Kerry, Max Baucus, and Representatives Jeb Hensarling, Fred Upton, Dave Camp, Chris Van Hollen, Xavier Becerra, and Jim Clyburn. Democratic and liberal groups donate the third most money, with about $9.6 million in political contributions to the health industry, and the health industry donated the fourth most, about $9.3 million. Club for Growth, a conservative free market group, donated more money than any other organization, contributing a combined $990,066 to 12 lawmakers. The vast majority of that money went to Senator Toomey.
See, you know, this is bullshit. This is kind of what's wrong with our political system right here, is that, you know, these guys are assigned to do this whole debt reduction thing, and, you know, they're quote-unquote super committee, and they're supposed to be cutting, like, what, $1.2 trillion in deficit cuts? $1.2 trillion. Well, I can guarantee that this isn't going to be happening with, you know, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, you know, and then the healthcare industry, and then these, you know, private political groups. I mean, it's all, everybody's buying what's going to be happening here, and it's bullshit. This isn't politics. This is, you know, corporate bullshit. That's exactly what it is.
I have no particular problem with all these organizations donating money, but I do think that the people actually making the decisions should have no way of knowing who's donating the money. That way they can't be biased by who's giving them what money.
I think that's a little bit easier said than done right there. I mean, you know, there's always ways for people to find out about stuff like that, especially whenever, you know, there's $990,000 involved, you know. I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea. I just think that it wouldn't be carried out quite that way.
Yeah, of course, none of these organizations will ever donate any of this money anonymously, because they want to make sure that these senators and representatives know that They want them in their pockets, so they'll make the right decisions to keep these businesses afloat and probably fuck everyone else. Moving right along into In Miscarriage of Justice news, thanks to Fat Ninja for this. The West Memphis 3 are free. After nearly 2 decades behind bars, the men known as the West Memphis Three have walked out of a courtroom as free men. I'm still very much in shock, still overwhelmed, that you have to kind of take into consideration that I spent most of the past decade in absolute solitary confinement, so I'm not used to being around anyone, said Damien Eccles. In 1993, the jury found Eccles, Jesse Miskelly Jr., and Jason Baldwin guilty of brutal murders of 3 Jonesboro I think that's Arkansas, boys, and what investigators believe was part of a satanic ritual. Eccles was sentenced to death, while the other 2 were given life in prison. Recent DNA evidence failed to link the men to their crimes. Instead holding a new trial, prosecutors released the 3 after a plea bargain on Friday. Now, I did a little background research on this. It looks like these 3 were convicted on very, very flimsy evidence that probably didn't even point them at all. I believe it would be practically impossible after 18 years to put on a proper case against these defendants in this case after such extended litigation, said attorney Scott Ellington. In a legal maneuver, all 3 entered what is called an Alford guilty plea while maintaining their innocence but acknowledging the state had evidence against them. The only thing that the state would do for us was say that we'll let you go if you admit guilt, and that's not justice. That's not justice no matter how you look at it. And they aren't out there trying to find whoever killed those boys, said Baldwin. With the new deal, the 3 men may leave the state of Arkansas, but must stay out of legal trouble for the next 10 years. So this is similar to what happened with Kevin Mitnick back in the day. These boys were convicted, and evidence basically popped up showing that these guys weren't the ones they're looking for. And in the case of Kevin Mitnick, there was no trial at all. And the only way these guys could get out of jail, even though the evidence was in their favor, was to plead guilty.
Yeah, you know, it's a big pile of bullshit here, you know, and the fact that they had to, you know, plead guilty, you know, even though it's an Alford guilty plea or however you pronounce that, you know, it's still bullshit that even though the state acknowledged that the evidence against them was completely flimsy and that they couldn't hold them, you know, these guys were on death row, you know, and it's taken 2 decades for them to figure out that these guys weren't guilty. That's just wrong, you know. I mean, I guess better late than never. But it's still, you know, that's not right, especially on such a high-profile case. Excuse me. But just a little tip. There you go. It's Arkansas, not Arkansas. It's you pronounce it differently than it's spelled.
Okay, yeah, that's one thing that most Canadians get wrong then. But with this here, like, this is misjustice on 2 fronts. One, they were convicted on pretty flimsy evidence to begin with. I can kind of understand that happening. But you don't give a death sentence to someone that was convicted on flimsy evidence. Then 2, when they find evidence to the contrary, saying these guys are innocent, they still refuse to acknowledge there was any fault here. Like, as soon as evidence was found saying that these guys weren't guilty, they should have been released immediately and given some sort of restitution for their trouble.
I don't know if there actually is restitution that you could get for 2 decades of your life, you know, especially spent on death row, you know, just essentially waiting to die. I don't really think that there's much in the way of restitution that you could get for that. I mean, that's the one thing that they take from you that you can never, ever, ever get back, you know, is people and time.
Well, you see, anything would be a lot better, even some money would be a lot better than saying, okay, well, you know, you can plead guilty and we'll let you go. That's kind of a kick in the nuts right after a slap to the face. They should have tried to do something to at least make their lives easier at this point.
I agree, you know, completely. I think that that doing that would be better than doing nothing at all. But, you know, still, I don't think that there's any appropriate restitution for 20 years of your frickin' life.
Well, this won't be the first time, and it won't be the last. So, moving right along into In Magic Pill News, thanks to Psychros. Modified ecstasy attacks blood cancers. Now, a little note here, and as Psychros mentioned in his email, there are some problems specifically with the terminology they chose to use in this article, but it's nothing new for the media. It's probably more the writers not knowing what the hell's going on rather than actual problems with the science here. Modified ecstasy could one day have a role in fighting some blood cancers, according to scientists. Ecstasy is known to kill some cancer cells, but scientists have increased its effectiveness 100-fold, said the Investigational New Drugs Journal. In their early study showed all, leukemia, lymphoma, and myeloma cells could be killed in the test tube by any treatment, but any treatment would be a decade away. As a charity said, the findings were a significant step forward. In 2006, a research team at the University of Birmingham showed that ecstasy and antidepressants such as Prozac had the potential to stop cancers from growing. The problem was that it needed doses so high they would have been fatal if given to people. The researchers, in collaboration with the University of Western Australia, have chemically re-engineered ecstasy by taking some of the atoms away and putting new ones in their place. The one variant increased cancer-fighting effectiveness 100-fold. It means that if 100 grams of unmodified ecstasy was needed to get the desired effect, only 1 gram of the modified ecstasy would be needed to have the same effect. Scientists say this also reduced the toxic effects on the brain. Lead researcher Professor John Gordon from the University of Birmingham told the BBC, against cancers, particularly the leukemia, the lymphoma, and the myeloma, we've tested these new compounds that can wipe out 100% of the cancer cells in some cases. I'm pretty sure that quote was taken out of context, but there you go.
You know, I really doubt that this is actually going to, you know, come to anything. Not because it's not effective, but because there's no money in cancer curing drugs. There's only, you know, money in treatment. And so the pharmaceutical corporations, well, you know, it would be a big deal to them, are going to try and keep the lid on it as much as possible.
I have to disagree in this case because of the fact that this needs to be modified so heavily, and there'll never actually be a cure for cancer because cancer is a flaw in our biology more than anything. But this looks like something that could be patented. Now, it sucks to say it, but pretty much all the cancer drugs that come out from big pharmaceutical companies are the ones that can be patented. So because they're modifying ecstasy, it looks like they can patent this. So I do think we'll see something to this effect in the next few years.
Another thing that makes me think that this specific one might not come about is because, especially here in the United States, we have a crazy anti-drug culture, and it's mostly the government than the people. But if there's anything at all possibly related to any type of drug, any type of illegal drug, it gets locked down faster than you can do anything. I mean, just look at like hemp products and stuff like that, how, you know, they really could revolutionize a lot of the way that we do business and things. And it's completely, you know, that they disregard it and completely just blow it off because, you know, even though it's so plentiful and so easily produced, because it's a derivative of, you know, cannabis, then it is, you know, totally villainized.
Well, that will definitely be a problem for you guys in the States because you guys got some pretty crazy drug enforcement on the go there. So I think this will become one of those things where people are leaving the States to get treatment in some, you know, ass end of the planet, just because the fact that the life-saving drugs they need aren't available in their country. But before
I could definitely see that happening.
Before you go out there and overdose an ecstasy to cure this, these drugs always work on specific types of cancer, so I'm pretty sure there's going to be a lot more restrictions that are going to come out about what this is useful for before they actually start releasing this drug to the public. Okay, moving along into incriminalizing children news, which is more miscarriage of justice, thanks to Unsung Kaishaku. Texas students sent from classroom to courtroom. In a small courtroom north of Houston, a fourth grader walked up to the bench with his mother. Too short to see a judge, he stood on a stool. He was dressed in a polo shirt and dark slacks in a sweltering summer morning. Guilty, the boy's mother heard him say. He had been part of a scuffle on a school bus. In another generation, he might have only received a scolding from the principal or a period of detention. But an array of get-tough policies in the U.S. and U.S. schools of the past two decades have brought many students into contact with police and courts, part of a trend some experts call the criminalization of student discipline. Now, such practices are under scrutiny nationally. Federal officials want to limit punishments that push students from the classroom to the courtroom, and a growing number of the state and local leaders are raising similar concerns. In Texas, the specter of harsh discipline is especially clear. Here, police issue tickets, Class C misdemeanor citations for offensive language, class disruption, and schoolyard fights. Thousands of students land in court with fines for up to $500. Students with outstanding tickets may be arrested after age 17. Texas also stands out for opening up millions of student records in a landmark study of discipline released in July. The study shows that 6 in 10 students were suspended or expelled at least once from 7th grade on. After the first suspension, they were three times more likely to be involved in the juvenile justice system in the next year, compared with students with no disciplinary action. Citing the Texas research, federal officials announced last month that an initiative to break what many call the school-to-prison pipeline. Suspensions, expulsions, and arrests are used too often to enforce school order, officials said. This is something that clearly has to stop, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said in Washington, alongside Education Secretary Duncan. This month, Duncan recounted that his old job in Chicago school as Chicago schools chief, he was stunned to learn that many arrests occurred in schools. His first response to student misbehavior, he said, can't be to pick up the phone and call 911. The federal focus comes amid another change. In Colorado, a legislative task force is examining discipline practices, including law enforcement referrals and school ticketing. Los Angeles police recently agreed to cut back on ticketing tardy students en route to school. Really, they ticket students on the way to school? Connecticut officials have begun screening cases after students wound up in court on violations for such as having soda, running in the hall, and dressing improperly. It's not that we don't think these things should be handled, said William Carbone, the state's executive director of court support services. We just think they should be handled in school rather than the court.
That last sentence there really, frames it up for me, how I feel on the issue, is that this is absolutely ridiculous. You know, we have a lot better things that we could be wasting our resources on instead of punishing, you know, things like running in the frickin' halls, you know. And part of the issue is that we have police officers on campus, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's not really a good thing either, you know, especially if you have some, you know, crazy fascist dickhead. And, you know, I'm pretty pro-police, you know, I know a lot of police officers, and most of them are pretty cool, but there are some just dickheads out there, you know what I mean? And having one of those guys in school, and then having all these zero-tolerance policies and stuff, it's just wrong, you know. Kids are gonna be kids are gonna get into trouble. That's, you know, that's it. That's just the way that it goes. And you putting these kids into court just makes it worse. It doesn't help things. They don't learn anything from it. They just realize that it's all bullshit, is essentially what it is that you're being punished for something retarded. And, you know, I had a run-in on campus. I got into a fight, and it actually turned into a criminal case. Because what ended up happening is I got jumped by somebody, and I fought back, and I ended up in court for it. Luckily, I was able to, I was able to plead my case well, and I was able to eventually have the charges dropped. So it turned out a lot better in my case than it would have in some other people's cases. But, you know, it definitely does happen in today's day and time, and I think it's wrong. I think that we definitely need to cut back on the whole police state bullshit. You know, kids are going to be kids. Kids are going to get into trouble. And, you know, we shouldn't be taking the kids to court over stupid shit. Especially a fourth grader.
See, the problem here is school officials, like teachers and whatnot, don't want to deal with the kids and actually address the problems that they're facing and stuff like that. They just want to get the kids out of their faces, so of course they hand over to the legal system. What we need is for those in the legal system to turn around and say, no, this is bullshit, we're not going to deal with this. We need police to refuse to hand out tickets for stupid little things like being late to school or having soda. We need judges to throw out cases being like, you know, this is clearly just a little scuffle, whatever, you know, this isn't even worth my time kind of thing. If that starts happening, then school officials are going to be forced to turn around and actually deal with the kids and fix the problems plaguing their schools instead of just handing them off to the justice system.
And you know, these are really symptoms, is the whole kids ending up in the legal system, is, you know, as teachers get more and more, you know, hindered by what they can and can't do in the school, you know, and the whole punishment is delegated from the teachers, you know, to saying, oh, so you want to get into a fight, hey? Well, you're going to stay late after school with me for 3 months, and you're going to be doing extra work, and that'll be your punishment. Instead, they're not able to do that anymore, and now they're being told, okay, well, if it happens, then just call the campus police officer, and the campus police officer will take care of it. And campus police officers are, you know, they're campus cops, yeah, but they're still cops, you know? And they're going to handle it like a cop would, and a cop deals with it, you know, with, like, a criminal matter.
In my school, they had a very good idea for dealing with troublesome students. What they would do is, because we had a lot of optional programs that were pretty fun, like stuff like photography and art and whatnot, what they would do is, if you kept getting in trouble, they would take away those programs and put you on the basic academic curriculum and put you one-on-one with a teacher. So there was no way you couldn't focus on your work, and you had to do the most boring, like you were doing more math than anyone, you were doing more physics than anyone kind of thing. And you would make up all your credits that you lost from your extra programs by doing more academic work, which everyone hated. And so not many kids dropped out, of course, because of the fact that culture's a little different up here. Parents actually give a damn about their kids so they don't let them drop out. But it was effective because of the fact that you're not going to cause trouble if you're going to lose all the programs you actually like about school.
That makes sense, you know, and I definitely could see something like that working. But again, you know, part of the issue here in the United States is, as well, is that we have so many kids, so little teachers, and then anything that they do is hindered by, you know, school administration and, you know, school policy and stuff like that. And unfortunately, it turns into more of a just pass the buck thing than an actually, you know, giving a shit about kids. And then, you know, parents are part of the cause of that as well. So, you know, it's a whole bunch of symptoms that all have one root problem, and that's essentially partly in our society.
Oh, yeah, we definitely need to force the teachers and hopefully the parents to actually care about what the kids are doing now and deal with the problems directly rather than trying to hand it off to the legal system. But moving right along, the future's not all bad news in cyberpunk farming news, thanks to Wyandi. Goodbye soil, researchers grow crops on thin films. Japanese researchers at Mebiol have discovered an innovative way to grow new plants and crops, substituting traditional soils with ultra-thin films made of hydrogel. The scientists have been able to successfully block the unwanted bacteria and viruses in soil that can be harmful to plants, especially removing dirt from the equation. Or essentially removing dirt from the equation, plants grow alongside the thin membrane of a hydrogel, a substance that is commonly found in diapers. The method isn't exactly a perfect replacement to traditional growing methods. Since water is absorbed at a much slower rate, that means plant sizes are limited, and only the healthiest and strongest varieties of plants can survive in the hydrogel. Despite this limitation, the researchers have been able to successfully grow tomatoes, spinach, and melons within the film. The researchers are hoping to one day make the film strong enough to support the growth of trees. And there's a video on the link about the hydrogel in action. Now, one thing I notice here is they say it's hard for it to bring water through really fast, but they can grow tomatoes and melons. So if they can grow that, I think they can grow just about anything.
You know, this really is cool because this could really take off in things like extended space operations and stuff like that, where dirt is really a problem, you know? I mean, it gets depleted and it, you know, gets all over the place, especially in a zero-G environment. You know, dirt really isn't very zero-G friendly. So having something like this really could, you know, help out with manned spaceflight and having renewable food on these manned spaceflights, renewable fresh food, which is really a big deal because, you know, you can only survive on prepackaged crap for so long before you just your body hates it. So, you know, this really could help out with, you know, terraforming planets, you know, with you know, colonizing other planets and extended space operations, and that's really cool. And it also could, you know, be absolutely great for, you know, hydroponic operations for, you know, low room gardens and stuff like that. You know, you have a small little corner of your basement, and instead of having dirt and all kinds of stuff there, you just have this film, and boom, there it is. And so this is really cool, you know. And like you said, if they can grow tomatoes and spinach and stuff, then they can grow quite a lot of things with that. Another thing is, it says that only the healthiest and strongest varieties of the plant survive. Now, if these are, you know, cross-pollinating and you're breeding these plants, it means that they're essentially evolving to be the, you know, healthiest and strongest plants will be the ones that will be breeding. So you can actually be breeding hardier and hardier plants as time goes along.
Oh yeah, this is definitely a novel method, not only for growing plants, but also cultivating them so they're stronger, rather than jumping straight into bioengineering them and splicing genes and stuff like that. This is something that's a lot more practical and will cause a lot less concerns that people have with genetically modified crops and stuff like that. Grow them this way, really accelerate how fast you weed out the bad genes, and away you go.
It also would mean that it would be fairly cheaper. You know, you don't have to pay a biologist and a genetic engineer and all these other guys to make these genetically engineered plants. They're doing it themselves. You know, they're essentially just using evolution naturally. And you know, they may have a high death rate to begin with, but it's, you know, weeding out the first plants. You know, they'd start growing these things in Earth, you know, in on the Earth before, like, say, a spacecraft was launched. You know, they'd start growing them a year before. So it would weed out all those weak plants, and it would start breeding the stronger plants before they even took off.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But more scary news here. We have in surveillance news, thanks to Psychros. Smart CCTV could track riders. CCTV that can automatically monitor criminal behavior and track suspects is being developed by UK scientists. Now, of course, this has been talked about for a while. Researchers at Kingston University have created a system that uses artificial intelligence to recognize specific types of behavior, such as someone holding a gun. The technology is capable of following the person across multiple cameras. Privacy campaigners have warned that it might be used to target groups such as political protesters. However, developers insisted that their invention would allow police to focus on lawbreakers and erase images of innocent civilians. The technology works by teaching a computer to recognize specific types of public behavior, known as trigger events. In riot situations, it could be people running, a crowd might converge in a certain place, said Dr. James Orwell, lovely name there, of Kingston University. If someone pulls out a gun, people tend to run in all sorts of directions. These movements can be detected. When an event is triggered, the software collates video footage from before and after the incident to record a full history of the suspect's movements. If a window is smashed and a shop looted in a town center street, the technology could trace back to see who smashed the window, then trace the steps to see when and where he entered the town center. The technology could also be used to trace where the man had gone after leaving the scene, said Dr. Orwell. The study is part of an AdPriv project, a European collaboration to build a surveillance solution that acknowledges wider privacy concerns. The key element of the system is the automatic deletion of surplus video data. I kind of doubt that. There is a mainland European resistance to CCTV, tight controls on how long it can keep data, explained Dr. Orwell. This project addresses it by saying that this is the event, let's wrap up everything that's relevant and delete everything else. We are seeking to use surveillance to help control society. That's a nice line there. While avoiding the Big Brother nightmare of everyone being seen all the time, he added.
Well, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. And really, this is, you know, yeah, crowd analyzing software is around. And yeah, I guess it kind of works. But really, you know, the uses of it are kind of limited. And part of it is people are going to be able to learn what the algorithms that they use to detect this stuff is, and they'll, you know, learn how to spoof it. Or, you know, just strap some super high intensity infrared LEDs to yourself and totally blind their cameras, or use lasers to, you know, disable the cameras. I mean, there are always ways around this stuff, and this doesn't help. You know, I mean, essentially, we've been using technology to try and, you know, help prosecute rioters and stuff like that, you know, especially, you know, with this latest round of UK riots, with them, like, you know, trying to lock down Facebook and, you know, instant messaging and blah, 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 and, you know, stuff like that. And I really see that the UK seems to have a real issue with this CCTV stuff. I don't understand why. I really can't understand the root cause of this whole CCTV fad, I guess, that's going on in the UK, but it's really disconcerting. And, you know, it really is kind of ignorant to show that how much they think they can get from this data, and really you're just going to get a lot of crap. And people will learn how to move and act so as not to get caught on these things. And yeah, that's just kind of the way it is. And another thing that was mentioned here is that infrared LEDs don't work on all cameras. Yeah, infrared LEDs don't work on all cameras, but also if you combine high-intensity LEDs just to begin with, just regular white light LEDs, it essentially has the same effect. It creates a big bloom. So infrared is a little bit nice for, you know, kind of low profile, but, you know, if you don't mind making a target of yourself, you know, you could set up like a little laser on a tripod and direct it right into the camera lens if it's a fixed lens, or you could just, you know, totally cover yourself with crazy high-intensity LEDs and, yeah, go on your way, and you'll essentially not be picked up by the cameras. But, you know, there are ways, again, like I'm saying, there are ways to spoof these and ways to get around these, and people are creative, and people will be able to get around.
The thing that strikes me here is that they keep saying they'll delete all the data of innocent people, which doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why would you delete all this data that you don't know if whether someone's in there that you need to get data from or not? I don't think they're planning to delete any of this. I think they're going to keep it and use it to trace back people even farther in time once they do pick them up for something else.
I think that's probably a good prediction there, and I think that's probably the way that it'll end up going if they do start using this stuff.
Oh yeah, exactly. But we have some more news here about what kind of problems will see us in the future. In cyberpunk overdosing news, thanks to Wyandi. Lawmakers call for probe of medical devices after researcher hacks insulin pump. Two federal lawmakers have asked the General Accountability Office to look into the security of medical devices after a researcher showed how he was able to hack his insulin pump and alter settings due to security flaws in the system. Representative Anna Eshoo and Ed Markey, members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, asked the GAO last week to investigate the safety of medical devices that have built-in wireless communications capabilities and could be susceptible to such attacks. In bringing forward innovative wireless technologies and devices for healthcare, it is critical that these devices be able to operate together and with other hospital equipment and not interfere with each other's activities and data transmissions, the lawmakers wrote in the letter to GAO. It is also important that such devices operate in a safe, reliable, and secure manner. Earlier this month, Jay Ratcliffe, a security professional who is also a diabetic, showed how an attacker could remotely control insulin pumps, deliver too much or too little insulin to the individual wearing the device. Ratcliffe, who conducted the research on his own pump and delivered his finding to the Black Hat Security Conference in Las Vegas, said that because his insulin pump doesn't encrypt communication or require authentication from the systems that communicate with it, an attacker could sniff the traffic and study how the devices communicate, then devise commands to inject insulin to inject into the communications traffic to alter the insulin dosage. He also found that he could control what information was fed to a diabetic's blood sugar monitoring device, so the individual would think he's receiving the right amount of insulin when he's not. My initial reaction was this is very cool from a technical perspective, Ratcliffe said to the Associated Press. My second reaction was then maybe one of sheer terror, to know there's no security around the devices, of which a very active part of keeping me alive.
I think that he has a very good point there, especially with that last sentence, that, you know, this is part of something that's keeping him alive. And I really do worry about all of these, you know, wireless communications with medical devices. And yes, it does make things easy, and they are able to interface and stuff. But again, you know, every piece of technology, especially wireless, can be, you know, can be broken, and the traffic can be read, the traffic can be spoofed, you know, and data can be changed. And that's something that I really, really worry about with medical devices. And the medical industry seems to be very, very not security conscious. And I don't know, I'm not exactly sure why or what the cause of that is, but they just seem to not really give a shit about security and not realize how security works in the real world. And that, you know, ramifications of somebody breaking into this could be, you know, your life. So I would much rather take an older piece of equipment that was not wireless, that, you know, may work a little bit less efficiently, and I might have to do a little bit more work with, and maybe monitor it a little bit more closely. But if it didn't have wireless transmissions, I think I would be much more interested in having that than one that was wireless. Just because of the sure, you know, presence of this article shows that there are issues with it.
Well, just like anything in the tech world, people are not willing to secure these things until a problem actually comes up. They don't like to think ahead because it's more work, it costs them more money to do the research. And I mean, that's a serious problem that we really need to address in the tech industry, is that we need to be anticipating these problems before they come up. Luckily, it was a researcher who just is interested in the technology who came up with this hack, instead of someone who's, you know, trying to assassinate someone or something to that effect. So, I mean, I really hope to take note of this and that the next generation of clocks are more secure, but you know, how many other problems of this like this are there out there? Okay, moving right along. Androids in space, thanks to Psychros. Now there's two links here. I'm only going to read from one, so if you want more information, just go check the forum post and get the other link. Humanoid robot walks in space, tweets. Robonaut 2, aka R2, was the first humanoid robot to become a permanent resident on the International Space Station, and was awakened from his stasis this week after 6 months in orbit. R2's first words? Those electrons feel good. No, really. Although we strongly suspect someone fed R2 that corny line, actually with the assistance of the Robonaut ground team, R2 has been tweeting for more than a year, even while sleeping. R2 arrived on the ISS in February, after hitching a ride there on the Space Shuttle Discovery's final mission. But due to the astronaut's hectic schedule of shuttle missions and science experiments, the crew is unable to do more than unpack it until now. Prior to activating R2, power was applied to its systems for several hours in order to evaluate the integrity of its wiring and connections. The warm-up period also gave the ground team a better understanding of how to operate R2 within the station's microgravity environment. As it turns out, heat buildup and dissipation on the ISS are difficult to replicate on the ground. Everything came alive, reports Robonaut Deputy Project Manager Nick Radford. We started getting video out of Robonaut's eyes. Everything worked exactly as we expected it to. It was a very, very exciting time. The initial success gives a green light to putting R2 through its first movements in orbit on September 1st. At that time, the ground team will send its commands to R2 to move its arms and hands. Assuming these and other tests proceeds without a hitch, R2 will start assisting the ISS crew with simple tasks in 2012. Really, it's taking that long to go from turning on a robot to getting a move? R2 was developed cooperatively by NASA and General Motors on an agreement to develop a robotic assistant that can work alongside humans, whether they are astronauts in space or work as a GM manufacturing plant.
No, this really is kind of an interesting idea of having, you know, a robot in space. It's very, very sci-fi and everything else, but it really is good to have something up there that can be, you know, assisting people and possibly affecting repairs, whatever humans would be unable or unwilling to go out there, you know, if there was some sort of danger, you know, lots of solar radiation, something like that. I'm not exactly sure because, you know, I've never been in space, but, you know, this is something really cool that we actually have something that we can control from the ground and, you know, affect minor repairs or assistance operations outside of the International Space Station, which, you know, that's some cool shit right there. You know, that's some really cool shit. Okay, and now moving on to Recomedia. What we have today is the Victoria Cross for Valor, thanks to Jewel Verboven, or Verboten, or whatever. Verboten. Jeremy Clarkson. it was marked at Verboten on my screen. Jeremy Clarkson presents a documentary on the Victoria Cross. Some people have been awarded it in their stories. It's focusing on Robert Kane, who was a Victoria Cross recipient. And for those of you who don't know, the Victoria Cross is kind of like the Medal of Honor, but for the Brits. So that's pretty much what it is. If you don't have any knowledge of that, what we also have is Jeremy Clarkson's Greatest Raid of All Time, also thanks to Jewel Verboven, and it's a BBC documentary presented by Jeremy Clarkson again on the Saint Nazarene Raid carried out by the Royal Marine Commandos. So that's some pretty cool stuff right there. You know, Jeremy Clarkson always makes for a good watch, and this stuff is pretty interesting. Now, moving on to Cyberpunk Kit, we have a 250 gigabyte on a disk the size of a CD, thanks to Wyandi. And researchers have found a way to store 50 gigabytes of data on a disk of glass no bigger than the screen of a basic mobile phone. The memory is highly durable, it can survive heat of up to 1,000 degrees Celsius, and is resistant to knocks and bumps that would do for a hard drive. Researchers at the University of Southampton use a powerful laser to etch nanostructures into a thin sheet of glass. Each nanostructure is a cube, roughly 1 micron in size, and consists of platelets about 10 nanometers in thickness, which are separated by 100 to 200 nanometers of space. Professor Peter Kazansky and, let me butcher this name here, Martinus Berensna told the Reg Hardware, When polarized light is passed through the structure, characteristics such as its radial and azimuthal polarization, essentially the angles at which light wave oscillates, change. The data is read by measuring degrees to which the output light differs from the light entering the storage structure. Each characteristic encodes a different data set, so it's possible to store multiple data sets in the same structure, enough to hold 260 gigabytes on a disk the size of a regular CD. The Boffins told me that this data could be erased and rewritten with the laser too. So essentially we have, you know, rewritable disks that can hold, you know, 250, 260 gigabytes of data, which is, you know, just outstanding. That's really a leap forward in you know, data storage. And, you know, couple that with the crazy, you know, like the crazy DVDs that we had last week, then, you know, you could really get some cool technology on the go. And for our daily hack, we have the Burning Man Pirate Ship sports Arduino-powered flame sails. The 2011 Burning Man Festival starts in just a few short days, and that we have, and with that, we have an excellent mutant vehicle accessory that's so insane that no insane desert dweller should be without. It's an Arduino-powered fire cane and sequencer. Paul was asked by Lost Machines Andy to spice up the flame effects on their pirate ship mutant vehicle, provide a cool-looking fire show that represented the ship's sails. So essentially, they have like a pirate ship mutant vehicle, and it has big, like, big flames for sails there. It's some pretty cool stuff. So if you know, if you like Burning Man, you like fire, go check that shit out.
And don't worry, we'll be back next week to get you news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We would like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or any pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out No Instruments by Neurotic Fish. We fade out now with Proletariat by B Complex. Remember, everyone, we cannot defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats, so until next time, that's what server said. End of line.